Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to the Bard's Grove.
Hi, Kat. How you doing?
Hey, Lantern. How are you?
Good, good. What's good news out there by you?
It's getting to be winter.
It is. It's really lovely. We've had a blustery cold day out here in southeast Florida. It fell all the way down to the 60s today.
Wow. We went down to the 40s and 30s last night with a lot of wind and a little snow in the mountains.
Cool.
Yeah. So winter is coming, and that's what this time of year is. It's really in the Celtic wheel of the year, we are in winter already. Samhain, or Halloween, All Hallows' Eve, is the beginning of winter for the Celts.
Ah.
And so we're already there. And the dark is rising. And although I do love this time of year right before the holidays, there's something very beautiful about it.
It's kind of that quiet before the frenetic pace of the seasons.
Yes, but also it's that sparkle. I mean, it's so Sagittarian. Now that, you know, when you know astrology and you know the flavor of the astrological signs, and then you watch to see how the seasons manifest that, it's quite amazing. Sagittarius is all about hope and possibilities and curiosity. And so there's this wonderful expectation, I guess you could say. And that's a good word to use with... because Jupiter, the planet Jupiter, Jupiter, of course, was Zeus, the father god of the Greeks, and he was the father, and Jupiter was the father god of the Romans. It was all about expansion and curiosity and expectation of something good happening. So it makes some kind of cosmic sense, I think.
Oh, that's great. Also, I guess we have Mercury retrograde to contend with, huh?
Yes, Mercury retrograde, and it's very interesting. I don't know if you felt it, but I've been talking to friends and acquaintances and clients, and the last few days have been kind of tense. And right now in the sky, there's what we call a T-square. It's like a 90-degree triangle, and at the point is the sun in Sagittarius, which is, what do I believe? That's what Sagittarius is all about, I believe. But it's squaring, 90-degree angle, so it's sort of like... it's like a crossroad, or it's a challenge. It's challenging Mars in Virgo, which says, okay, how do I deal with my desires and manifest them? And then it's also squaring the moon in Pisces, which is opposite Mars. So there's the rest of the triangle. And so basically the whole energy of the last few days has been, oh my God, what do I believe? Can I really manifest what I want? Or is it all a lie? And so if people have been going back and forth, that might be... you know, partly due to this pressure that we have about what do I believe? And I don't know, how about you, Lantern? Have you run into people sort of, you know, wanting to believe like in the Occupy movement and yet seeing, you know, that the Federal Reserve just gave $11 trillion or something like that to the banks?
Oh, the poor dears. And, you know, I think I have a lot of sympathy for my Republican friends who one week they're believing in that chap from Texas that makes George Bush look like a whiz kid.
Yeah.
And then the next week they're believing in this hairdo from Minnesota.
Yeah.
And the next week they're believing in some guy who's fresh from, what is it, Godfather? What a curious symbol to ally oneself with, you know. And now they've returned to the lizard. They're back with the newt. So we'll see. You know, I mean, I think they've probably got a crisis in belief like nobody's business.
Yeah, you know, it is a crisis in belief, and you know, that's what the cosmic story is all about. The energy, the interplay of these planetary energies. It's sort of like God's way of saying, okay. This is the message of what's going on right now. You're all going to fall into a crisis of faith. And what are you going to choose? You know, what are you going to choose?
I've chosen an anecdote as a creativist. I'm writing an essay right now. It's the third part of a kind of a fabulous tale of Obama. Part one was O is for Occupy, where I imagined what it would be like if President Obama joined the Occupy movement and spent the night. And then part two I called On the Ramparts, where President Obama came down to the NYC index and threw the moneylenders out of the stock exchange. And part three I'm polishing off right now, the final edit. Part three is called Obama, the Exorcism. Where I have him lead a New Orleans-style jazz funeral parade to the Pentagon, celebrating the end of the military-industrial complex.
I think we need good stories like that out there. Possibilities, humor, satire, most definitely. Artists, you know, are the ones who need to tell us those stories. So, speaking of which, do you have a story for us tonight?
Oh, do I have a story for you. I've reached up to the cold north of the Russian steppes for a story called Tsarevich Peter and the Wizard.
Oof.
And here we go. In an old, olden times, when God's world was full of wizards and forest monsters, and when the rivers ran with sweet milk, there lived a czar named Belobaline with his Tsaritsa and their three sons, Alexei, Dmitri, and Pyotr. Lads, comely and clever, all three of them. One day, Tsaritsa, who had gone to walk on the open steppes, failed to return to the palace, and though wide search was made, no trace could be found of her. She had disappeared as completely as if she had fallen into the water. Then Tsar Belobaline called together his ministers and boyars, his sages, his grandees and counselors, and asked their advice. And when they deliberated for 3 weeks, the eldest among them came before him and said, "O Tsar Majesty, it is clear that the Tsaritsa has been spirited away by Ketchke, the most powerful of all the wizards. And while his own realm and castle are beyond 9 times, and he possesses strongholds many and various in other tsardoms, it has long been known that his most splendid palace are upon the tops of the highest, most inaccessible mountains in the next tsardom to thine own. It is, however, bootless to war against him, for his palaces each, every one, are surrounded by enchantment, and Kache himself cannot be killed by mortal means, since he carries his life not in his body, but in a secret place that's known not only to himself. We counsel thee, therefore, to choose another wife, for thy lost Tsaritsa wilt thou never regain again as long as the world lasteth." The Tsar was deeply saddened by this speech. So much did he love his vanished Tsaritsa that he would not choose another in her place, but sent criers far into far kingdoms, offering wealth and honors to whomever would restore her to him. Daring heroes and great generals came in response from all sides, east promising valiant deeds. And Tsar Belobaline bid each take from the royal treasury sufficient gold for his needs. But though scourges arrived and rode away, there came no news of the missing Tsaritsa. One day, as the Tsar sat musing sadly and troubled at heart in his summer house, his three sons came into the garden, and not knowing that he was within hearing, began to converse. "Methinks our little father is bereft of his reason," said Alexei, the eldest. "These boasting heroes who come from afar are galloping off with all his treasures. He is a fool to put his faith in them. I warrant I could do as well as they." "Dmitri," the second son said, "doubtless they are but sorry scoundrels who play upon our Tsar father's credulity. With a tenth of the sum that has been given them, I myself would find our little mother." But Pyotr, the youngest, said, "Not so, my brothers. If Ketche, the wizard, has her, it will need a stout heart to bring her back, and who knoweth where that may be found, Would, however, that our little father would send us abroad to do our best. When the lads had left the garden, Tsar Belbelanin re-entered the palace and summoned them to his presence. My dear sons, he said, ye know how the loss of thy mother oppresses my heart and soul. Many brave heroes have searched for her vainly, and I am minded now to send one of you forth. Thou, therefore, Alexei, who art my eldest, take my fatherly blessing, with as much gold and as many troops as thou requirest, and try thy fortune in the quest. If thou dost succeed, thou shalt inherit my tsardom. So, boasting much, Tsarevich Alexei took from the treasury a full purse, and with 50,000 soldiers armed with iron lances set out from the capital. He rode one day, he rode 1 week, he rode a month and two and three, asking questions of all he met, until he had passed beyond the borders of his father's tsardom. But no one had heard of the lost Tsaritsa, or of the strongholds of Kachay the wizard. At length, he came through fen and morass to a desert land where only the earth and sky were seen, and the sand was as hot as the cinder cakes. And here his hosts vanished one by one until but 10 remained. Beyond the desert was a forest, and on the skirt of the forest, in a patch of wild hemp and bramble, he came upon an old graybeard, a yard tall, sitting on a stone. Health to thee, grandfather, said Tsarevich Alexei. Health to thee, Tsarevich, replied the old man. Where doth God carry thee? Art thou come hither to shirk a task, or to find one? To find one, answered Tsarevich Alexei. I, who seek the stronghold of Kachay the wizard, who has stolen away my little mother. Thou art on the right track, said the other, but thou wilt not be able to reach it. Why not? Asked Tsarevich. Because, said the graybeard, there must be 3 broad rivers between, over which thou must be ferried, and the price asked is a great one. Tsarevich Alexei threw the old man a piece of money. I have gold and to spare, he said, haughtily, spurring forward, rode on to the first of the 3 rivers. There, waited on its bank, a ferryman covered with scales of copper like a tortoise, with a head like a cask, and so huge of stature that the horses that carried the Tsarevich 10 men snorted with terror and, turning, galloped away with their riders. The Tsarevich approached trembling and said, Oh, ferryman, wilt thou ferry me over?
If thou pay me my price, answered the ferryman.
What is thy price? Asked the Tsarevich.
I will bring thee back for naught, but for carrying thee across, I shall strike off thy right hand.
Tsarevich Alexei saw the sharp sword girded at the ferryman's side, and his rebellious head drooped lower than his broad shoulders. Of small use to myself should I be without my good right hand, he thought. Yet, if I succeed, I shall be Tsar, and the Tsardom is worth the price. So he bade the other take him across, and on the further side the ferryman drew his sword and struck off his right hand. Bemoaning its loss, the Tsarevich spurred on alone. He rode 1 day, he rode 2 and 3, and he came to the second river. And on its bank waited a ferryman as tall as a fir tree, armored with plates of silver and of such a countenance that Tsarevich Alexei's heart fainted for very fear. And turning, he struck spurs to his steed and rode back the way he'd come to his own tsardom. When he reached the capital, he entered the palace, came to his father and said, Gracious sir, I have searched these months through in many lands, until there remains not a single man of a great host, while I myself have lost my right hand, but no trace of Kachay, the wizard, or of the Tsaritsa, my little mother, could I find. Then Tsar Belbelanin embraced him. and wept over him. And summoning his second son, said, "My dear Dmitri, take my blessing with gold and troops as much and as many as thou wilt, and go forth and try. And if thou dost succeed, thou shalt have my tsardom after me." Dmitri, vowing that he would do better than his brother, took a knapsack full of gold and 100,000 soldiers officered by captains of captains and set off. He, too, came at length through swamp and bog to the desert of hot sand, and here his men vanished there till they were left but a score. And at the edge of the further forest, in an acre of wild hemp and bramble, he came across an old woman, a yard tall, sitting on a stone. "Health to thee, grandmother," said he. "And to thee, Tsarevich," she answered. "Where doth God carry thee? Why comest thou hither? To escape a task, or to meet one?" "To meet one," he replied. "I seek the retreat of the wizard Cachet, who hath stolen away my little mother." "Thou goest in the right direction," the old woman said, "but all the same, thou wilt never reach it." "Why? Why not?" asked the Tsarevich. "Because," answered the old woman, "there are three wide rivers between, on each of which is a ferry, and the price asked thee will be a great price." Tsarevich Dmitri threw her two pieces of gold. "I have plenty of such," he said scornfully, and rode on to the river. When they saw the gigantic ferryman, however, with his frame covered in copper armor, the horses, his 20 men, rode, struck with terror, galloped away, and the Tsarevich approached him trembling alone. He, too, was ferried over at the cost of his right hand, and lamenting its loss, rode on alone to the second river. And there, though the fierce aspect of the ferryman made his horse sweat and his own very heart shake, he approached and asked, "O ferryman, wilt thou ferry me across?" "If thou wilt pay my price," answered the ferryman. "And what is thy price?" asked the Tsarevich. "I will bring thee back for naught," said the ferryman. "But for ferrying thee over, I shall strike off thy left foot." The Tsarevich's bright head hung lower than his stalwart shoulders. "I have already given my right hand," he thought, "and a foot is not so much more when a tsardom is its reward." So he bade the other carry him over. And when they had crossed, the ferryman drew his sword and struck off his left foot. And the Tsarevich Dmitri rode on. He went one day, and two, and then three. And finally he came to the third river, on whose bank stood a ferryman as tall as a tower, with legs like buttresses, clad all in golden armor, with a face so fierce and terrible that the Tsarevich's courage died within him. So he turned his horse about, and in mortal fear spurred back the way he'd come to his own tsardom. There, coming before his father, he said, "Gracious sir, I have wandered these many months through strange lands till there is not left one of my great army I took. And as for me, I have, as thou seest, lost my right hand and my left foot, but I found no sign of the wizard or of my little mother, the Tsaritsa." Tsar Belbelenin kissed him, grieved over him, and then, sending for his youngest son, bade him also take what he might require. "Go and search." "I have no need of either gold nor an army, little father," said Tsarevich Peter. "Give me only a horse of my own choosing and a sword fit for a hero." His father bade him choose the best blade from his armory and the finest steed in his stables. Tsarevich Peter went to the armory accordingly and tested the blades for a month till he had picked the keenest and the strongest. Then he bade the stable grooms collect all the Tsar's stud horses, drive them out to the blue sea ocean, and watched to see what they would do. One swam far out and began to wrestle with the waves till the water boiled and dashed against the shore as in a tempest. And him, Tsarevich Pyotr, chose. He took his father's blessing, girded on the keen sword, and mounting the horse, set forth. He rode for a day and a night, for a week, for 1 month, then for three. He passed the quagmire and the fiery desert, and at the edge of the forest in a plot of wild hemp and briar met the little old man and the little old woman sitting on two stones. He told them of his errand, and the graybeard said, "Thou hast a keen sword and the horse of a hero, but all the same thou wilt not get to the cachet." "Why not?" asked Tsarevich. "Because," replied the other, "thou must first pass three rivers. At each river is a ferry, and the price each ferryman asks is a great one, for the first will strike off thy right hand, the second thy left foot, and the third thy head." "Well," answered Tsarevich Pyotr, "a man can die but once." And he thanked him and made to ride on, but the old man stopped him. "Thou art both brave and courteous too," he said, "and perchance thou mayst cross the three rivers. If thou dost, ride straight on until thou reachest a high mountain, and on whose top are the four palaces of cachet. At the base of the mountains is a cave with an iron door. Enter it, and thou wilt find four iron claws. Bind these to thy hands and feet, and it may be thou wilt be able to reach the top." The Tsarevich bade the old man and old woman farewell. He rode on to the first river and demanded to be ferried over.
"Wilt thou pay my price?" asked the huge ferryman.
"Time enough to talk of price when thou hast served me thy service," said the Tsarevich, and he rode his horse into the boat. So they crossed, and when they came to the other side, he asked, "What is there to pay?"
"Stretch forth thy right hand," said the ferryman, and drew his sword.
"Nay," answered Tsarevich Pyotr, "I need my hand myself," and he whipped out his own blade and struck the ferryman such a blow that the steel pierced through the copper armor and killed him. He fell with a crash into the water, and Tsarevich, pulling the boat high up on the shore, rode on to the second river. There, the like happened when the gigantic ferryman bade him stretch forth his left foot. The Tsarevich, drawing a sword, sprang upon him before the blade had left its scabbard and smote him a blow that cleaved him through the silver plates of his armor and killed him in a moment. Then the Tsarevich secured the boat and rode on to the third river. And on the bank stood a wild man, tall as a giant and as thick as a haystack, with a shield, helmet, and breastplate, all of gold, and with an oak club in his hand. Tsarevich Pyotr, however, was not daunted, nor did his horse show fear. He rode aboard and bade the giant ferryman ferry him over. And when they came to the other side, he asked, "What is there to pay?"
"Stretch out thy neck," said the ferryman, "that I might strike off thy head."
But even as he lifted his huge oaken club, the Tsarevich sprang in under his shield and dealt him such a blow with his tested sword that the point shivered the gold breastplate and killed him. Tsarevich Pyotr fastened the boat and rowed on, and presently came to a mountain so high that its top was propped against the sky, and he could scarce lift his eyes to the summit. He turned out his good horse to graze on white summer wheat on the open steppe, and searched till he came upon the iron door and entered the cave. Here he found the four iron claws. Binding them to his hands and feet, began to climb the mountain. For a whole month he climbed higher and higher, and finally he reached the top, which was so high that from it one could see the whole world with all its countries, spread out as if on the palm of the hand. Here he took off his iron claws, thanked God, and after resting 3 days went straight before him. Whether the way was long or short, he came at length to the vast palace built all of copper. No guard stood at its gate, and he entered. Each room through which he passed was of copper. In the inmost chamber sat a maiden on a copper chair, embroidering upon a copper frame, and the scissors, the thimble, the needles she used were of copper. He greeted her and told her his quest. "This is indeed the palace of Cachet, good youth," said the damsel. "I, too, was stolen away from my father's tsardom by the wizard, who comes hither to visit me once every 3 months. I know not of thy little mother, but if thou goest further to the Cachet's second palace, perhaps thou mayst hear of her. The wizard is hard to conquer, however, and thou art the first who's been able to come thus far. Shouldst thou succeed, I pray thee, remember me, and take me back with thee to the white world." Tsarevich Pyotr promised her this, and setting out, traveled for the space of a day till he came to a palace even more splendid than the first, built all of silver. It, too, was unguarded, and entering, he found its further chamber a damsel sitting on a silver stool, weaving on a silver loom with a thread of pure silver. Her also he greeted and told his errand. "I, too," she said, "was stolen away from my father's realm by a wizard and brought to this very palace whence I've come. He visits me once every 2 months. I have not seen thy little mother. But go thou to Cachet's third palace beyond this, and perchance, thou mayst hear of her. If thou meetest and art victor over him, forget me not, I beseech thee, but take me with thee to the white world." The Tsarevich gave the damsel his promise and set out at once. The next day came to the palace wealthy and magnificent, which blazed like fire in the sunlight, for it was built entirely of gold. Like the others, it was unguarded, so he entered and explored it. In its inmost chamber he found a damsel sitting on a golden divan, making lace on a golden pillow, and both the shuttle and the thread were of purest gold. The damsel was of such beauty that it could not be described, but only told in a tale, and Tsarevich Pyotr could not look at her enough. "Health to thee, beautiful maiden," he said. "Health to thee, Tsarevich," she replied. "But how comest thou hither? By thine own will or by force?" "By mine own will," he answered. "I seek my little mother, who is stolen away from my father's tsardom by Cachet." "Canst thou tell me where she is?" "Why should I not be able?" she rejoined. "I too was stolen from my father's tsardom by the wizard, who visits me here once each month. But thy little mother he keeps in his fourth palace, which is built of pearl, and thither thou must go. But I implore thee, if thou dost overcome and slay the monster, remember me, and take me with thee to the white world. Sooner than leave thee here to Cachet, will I give my own life," he answered. "Never fear that I would ever forget thee." "Hearken now," she said. "When thou comest to the last of the wizard's palaces, thou wilt see that it lies in a garden which is surrounded like a wall by an enormous serpent coiled with its tail in its mouth. Take this bundle of herbs, and when thou comest to the open field around the palace, choose a spot where the wind doth blow from thee toward the serpent, and there build a fire, and throw some of the herbs into that flame. Mind that thou do not use it all, and that thyself stand behind the wind. The smoke will cause the serpent to fall asleep, and thou mayst then climb over its body and enter the palace." Tsarevich Pyotr bade her farewell and set out. And when he had traveled a day, he came to the palace that rose dazzling white from the midst of the green garden, and all about the garden lay coiled a huge snake, a living, scaly wall. He went into the meadow, built a fire, and threw upon it some of the sprigs of the herbs, and from it arose a great volume of smoke, which the wind drove toward the serpent, causing it to fall asleep. He then climbed over it and entered the palace of pearl. He passed through room after room till he came to the inmost of all, and there he saw his little mother sitting on a high pearl throne, dressed in a robe of brocade sewn with seed pearls and wearing a Tsaritsa's pearly crown. When she saw him, she ran to him, embracing him, fell to weeping. "How hast thou found me here?" she cried. "My brave and beloved son, for I, thy mother, am in the power of this mighty wizard who comes to me each day. Thou wilt strive to overcome him, yet he is strong in his enchantments, while thou art but an untried youth, so that I greatly fear for thee." "The wind doth not blow forever," said the Tsarevich. And he comforted his mother, and they kissed and caressed one another, and there rose a roaring of wind so that all the crystal windows rattled. "Kache comes even now," she said. "Hide thee quickly beneath my mantle." He concealed himself, and scarce had he done so when the wizard entered, green-eyed, naked, and hairy, with a bared sword in his hand and a nose curved like a scimitar. He hastened to the Tsaritsa and began to pet and fondle her. "Hast thou been lonely, light of mine eyes?" he asked. "Yes," she answered. "Thou travelest far and hast many enemies, and I fear for thy life." "No fear of that," he said. "My life I carry not in my body, but in another place." "Where is that place?" she asked. "It is the broom that stands beside the door," he answered. "But now I am tired and I would sleep." He laid his head on the Tsaritsa's knees and slept. And while the Tsarevich lay hidden, and when he awoke, he bade her farewell tomorrow and departed in a whirlwind from the palace. Then the Tsaritsa went and fetched the broom, and bringing a quantity of precious stones, bade Tsarevich Peter sew them all about it. This he did, and when she returned it to its place, and they spent the afternoon in conversation. The next day, as they sat together, there came again the sound of the howling wind, and a second time she concealed the Tsarevich beneath her mantle. When the wizard entered and began to fondle her as before, presently he saw the broom and asked, "Why, thou dearest woman, hast thou strewn a common broom with jewels?" "Because," she said, "thou didst tell me that it contained thy life, and thy life is more precious to me than many jewels." He embraced her more tenderly and said, "I did but tell thee that to try thee. My life is not in the broom, but it's in the hedge that rings the garden." And then, when he'd slept and refreshed himself, he bade her farewell to the morrow and departed in his whirlwind. The Tsaritsa at once fetched a quantity of gold and said to the Tsarevich, "Go thou and cover the garden hedge with this every twig and leaf." He did so, and they spent the afternoon in conversation as before. The next day, there came again the sound of the shrieking wind, and the Tsarevich concealed himself for a third time. Kache entered, began to fondle the Tsaritsa. "Love of my heart," he said, "as I came thither, I saw that thou hast covered the garden hedge with gold. Why hast thou done so?" "For the reason," she answered, "that thou didst tell me that thy life was contained within it, and thy life is more dear to me than much gold." The wizard caressed her in that most tender fashion. "But I did tell thee that," he said, "to try thee again still further. Now, however, I am assured that thou dost truly love me. Know that my life is neither the broom nor the hedge, but is in an egg. The egg is in a duck, and the duck is in a hare, and the hare nests in the great hollow log that floats in the pond in the forest of the island of Bonyan." Having thus spoken, Kache put his head on the Tsaritsa's knee and slept, and soon, awaking, bade her farewell and departed. Tsarevich Pieter came from his concealment and to his mother said, "This time Kache has told truly wherein his wicked life lies. Only when thou hast found the egg canst thou truly overcome him. Go therefore with God, for here thy life is in danger each moment." So he embraced her. Burning in the garden some of the herb which the maiden of the golden palace had given him, he climbed over the serpent and went his way. He passed the gold, the silver, the copper palaces without stopping. He found his iron claws and began to climb down the mountain. At the end of a month he reached its foot and left the iron claws in the cave. He found his horse grazing on the open steppe and set out for the island of Bunyan. He rode a long, long way. He rode a short way, and at length he came to the sea ocean. And on its sand, gasping out its life, lay a stranded pikefish. And pitying its plight, the Tsarevich dismounted, picked it up and threw it in the water. Remounting his good horse, he spurred it to the water and began to swim to the island of Bunyan. It swam one day It swam two, and on the third it reached the island. Leaving his steed to rest, Tsarevich Pyotr went straight to the forest. He had scarce entered it when he came upon a great bear, whose paw was caught beneath the fallen tree. Drawing his sword, he cut the creature loose and went on. Presently he saw an otter, fast in a snare. He released the otter, and a little further he found a hawk, struggling in a tangle of vines. He freed the hawk also, pressing on, soon came to the pond. In the middle of it floated a great branchless log, but it was beyond his reach. He began to wonder what he should do, and a heavy rain began to fall, and the water of the pond rose. He climbed a tree, and when the log floated near it, he secured it. And when the rain ceased and the water fell, he attacked the log with his sword, but so huge it was that it could not cut through it. Suddenly, while he labored, the bear he had befriended rushed from the wood and tore the log asunder with its great paws. Out of the log leapt a hare. But the otter that he had released sprang from the thicket, pursued the hare, and caught it, tore it to pieces. From the hare flew a duck, but the hawk he had freed darted after it into the sky and seized it. The duck thereupon laid an egg, and the egg fell into the sea. While the Tsarevich was bemoaning its loss with tears, there came swimming to the shore the pikefish, whose life he had spared, bringing him the egg in its mouth. Then Tsarevich Pyotr put the egg in its belt, mounted his horse, which swam back with him across the sea ocean, having rested, set out again for the mountains of Cachet. The telling is easy, but the labor is hard. Whether he rode for a week or a month, he came at length to the mountain. He left his horse to graze on the steppe, and binding the iron claws to his feet and hands, climbed again to the summit, hastened to the palace of pearl. Again he burned some of the drowsy herb, climbed over the serpent, entered, embraced his mother, and showed her the egg. And before long there arose the sound of the whistling wind, and in came Cachet. He ground his teeth when he saw the Tsarevich, and would have rushed him at once, but Tsarevich Pyotr squeezed the egg in his hand ever so slightly, and as he did so, the fierce light grew dim in the wizard's eye. Tsarevich tossed the egg from right hand to left, and the cachet was hurled violently from one corner of the room to the other. With a last effort, the wicked wizard strove to reach his enemy with his sword. But Tsarevich Pyotr threw the egg on the ground, and it broke. And instantly, Cachet fell down dead, and the serpent that coiled about the garden vanished. The Tsarevich made a great pyre, burned the body of the wizard to ashes, and scattered the ashes to the winds. Then with his mother he set out for their return. The lovely damsel of the gold palace met them with joy, and her the Tsarevich kissed on her sugar-sweet mouth, and they plighted their troth that moment. Taking her with him, they visited the palaces of silver and copper, and the maidens imprisoned there welcomed them with gladness and accompanied them. Then, when they came to the brink of the steep descent, Tsarevich Pyotr found his iron claws once more, donned them, and tearing into strips the outer robes of the three maidens, twisted a rope by means of which, as he climbed down, he lowered them with his mother down the mountain. And when they reached the level ground, he caught his good steed, set his mother upon it, and they and the three Tsarinas set out for the Tsardom, his father. In the forest which skirted the mountains of hot sand, they came across the old man and woman sitting upon two stones. "So thou hast slain Cachet," said the greybeard. "Now I rejoice also, for he was my greatest enemy. He gave them four noble steeds, a milk-white mare to bear the Tsarina, the stallions of gold, of silver, of copper color for the three Tsarevnas, and in his wish they rode to the Tsardom of Tsar Bel-Belenin. And when they drew near the capital, the Tsarevich sent in advance a swift messenger to the Tsar with this message: 'Little father, I, thy son Pyotr, am returning home, bringing with me my mother, the Tsaritsa, my own bride-to-be, who is as maiden as lovely as the stars, and the Tsarevnas for my two brothers. Come thou out to meet us.' The Tsar hearing the message, could not believe his ears. He mounted and rode out of the capital at the head of all his ministers and boyars and his army. And when he saw that it was indeed true, and that his well-beloved Tsaritsa was alive, his joy knew no bounds. He ordered the musicians to play their instruments, and the drummers to beat their drums, and bring with them to the palace, decreed a great festival, whose splendor made the whole Tsardom wonder. And when the feasting was ended, Tsarevich Pyotr wedded the lovely damsel of the gold palace, and the maidens of the silver and copper palaces were wed to his brothers, the Tsarevich Alexei and Dmitri, and soon after Tsar Belin-Belinin laid down his scepter, and Tsarevich Pyotr ruled the Tsardom after him. He rejoiced in his good fortune without boasting. His subjects loved and feared him, and his life was long, and his reign was glorious. And so ends the tale.
Very, very nice.
Thank you, my dear cat.
Very nice. Well, why don't I do my story, and then if we have some time, we'll talk about why we picked them. I picked a story to read called Blackbeard, and I picked it because one of the things about Sagittarius is about curiosity, and this is definitely a story about some of the drawbacks of too much curiosity. This is the version that Clarissa Estes used in her book. There is a hank of beard which is kept in at the convent of the white nuns in the far mountains. How it came to the convent, no one knows. Some say it was the nuns who buried what was left of his body, for no one else would touch it. Why the nuns would keep such a relic is unknown, but it's true. My friend's friend has seen it with her own eyes. She said the beard is blue, indigo-colored to be exact. It is as blue as the dark ice in the lake, as blue as the shadow of a hole at night. This beard was once worn by one who they say was a veiled magician, a giant man with an eye for women, a man known by the name of Bluebeard. 'Tis said he courted three sisters at the same time, but they were frightened of his beard with its odd blue cast, and so they hid when he called. In an effort to convince them of his geniality, he invited them on an outing in the forest. He arrived leading horses arrayed in bells and crimson ribbons. He set the sisters and their mothers upon the horses, and off they cantered into the forest. There they had a most wonderful day riding, and their dogs ran beside and ahead. Later they stopped beneath a giant tree, and Bluebeard regaled them with stories and fed them dainty treats. And the sisters began to think, well, perhaps this man Bluebeard isn't so bad after all. They returned home all a chatter about how interesting the day had been and why they and did they not have a good time. Yet the two older sisters' suspicions and fears returned, and they vowed not to see Bluebeard again. But the younger sister thought if a man could be that charming, then perhaps he was not so bad. Silly girl. The more she talked to herself, the less awful he seemed, and also the less blue his beard. So when Bluebeard asked for her hand in marriage, she accepted. She had given his proposal great thought and felt she was to marry a very elegant man. And so marry they did, and after rode off to his castle in the woods. One day he came to her and said, I must go away for a time. Invite your family here if you like. You may ride in the woods, charge the cooks to set a feast. You may do anything you like, anything your heart desires. In fact, here is my ring of keys. You can open any and every door to the storerooms, the money rooms, any door in the castle. But this little tiny key here, the one with the scroll work on the top, do not use it. His bride replied, yes, I'll do as you ask. It sounds very fine. So go, dear husband, and don't worry, and come back soon. And so off he rode, and she stayed. Her sisters came to visit, and they were, as all souls are, very curious about what the master had said was to be done while he was away. And the young wife gaily told them, he said we may do anything we desire and enter any room we wish, except for one. I don't know which one it is. I just have a key and I don't know which door it fits. Well, the sisters decided to make a game of finding which key fit which door. The castle had was three stories high, with 100 doors in each wing, and there were as many keys on the ring. And so they crept from door to door, having an immensely good time throwing open one door after another. Behind one door were the kitchen stores. Behind another, the money stores. All manner of holdings were behind the doors, and everything seemed more wonderful all the time. And at last, having seen all these marvels, they came finally to the cellar, and at the end of the corridor, a blank wall. Now, they puzzled over the last key, the one with the little scroll work on top. Maybe this key doesn't fit anything at all. As they said this, they heard an odd sound. They peered around the corner, and lo and behold, there was a small door just closing. When they tried to open it again, it was firmly locked. And one cried, "Sister, sister, bring your key here. Surely this is the door for that mysterious little key." Well, without a thought, one of the sisters put the key in the door and turned it. The lock scolded, the door swung open, but it was so dark inside they could not see. "Sister, sister, bring a candle." So a candle was lit and held into the room, and all three women screamed at once, for in the room was a mire of blood, and the blackened bones of corpses were flung about, and skulls were stacked in corners like pyramids of apples. They slammed that door shut so fast they shook the key out of the lock and leaned against one another, gasping, their breasts heaving, "Oh my God, oh my God." The wife looked down at the key and saw it was stained with blood. Horrified, she used the skirt of her gown to wipe it clean, but the blood prevailed. "Oh no! Oh no!" Each sister took the tiny key in her hand and tried to make it as it once was, but the blood remained. The wife hid the tiny key in her pocket and ran to the cook's kitchen. When she arrived, her white dress was stained red from the pocket to the hem, for the key was slowly weeping drops of dark red blood. She ordered the cook, "Quick! Quick, give me some horsehair." She scoured the key, but it would not stop bleeding. Drop after drop after drop of pure red blood issued from that tiny key. She took the key outdoors, and from the oven she pressed ashes onto it and scrubbed some more. She held it to the heat to sear it. She laid cobweb over it to staunch the flow. But nothing could make the weeping blood subside. "Oh, what am I to do? Oh, I know. I put the little key away. I'll put it in the wardrobe. I'll close the door. This is a bad dream. This is really a bad dream. Okay. Everything will be all right. Everything will be all right." And this she did do. She put it away. Well, her husband came home that very next morning, and he strode into the castle calling for his wife. Well, how was it when I was away?" "It was very fine, sir." "And how are my storerooms?" he mumbled. "Oh, very fine, sir." "How are my money rooms?" he growled. "The money rooms are very fine also, my dear husband." "So everything is good, wife?" "Oh, yes, yes, everything is good." "Well," he whispered, "then you had best return my keys." With a glance, he saw a key was missing. "Where is the smallest key?" "I lost it. Yeah, I lost it. I was out riding. The key ring fell down, and I must have lost the key." "What have you done with it, woman?" I really don't remember. I don't know." "Don't lie to me. Tell me what you did with that key." He put his hand to her face as if to caress her cheek, but instead seized her hair. "You infidel," he snarled and threw her to the floor. "You've been into that room, haven't you?" He threw open her wardrobe, and the little key on the top shelf had bled blood red down all the beautiful silks of her gowns hanging there in the closet. "Now it's your turn, my lady," he screamed, and he dragged her down the hall and into the cellar till they were before the terrible door. Bluebeard merely looked at the door with his fiery eyes, and the door's opened for him, and there lay the skeletons of all his previous wives. And now, he roared, but she caught hold of the doorframe and wouldn't let go. She pleaded for her life. Please, please, please allow me to compose myself and prepare for my death. Give me but a quarter of an hour before you take my life so I can make my peace with God. All right. All right, you have a quarter of an hour, but be ready. Well, the wife raced up the stairs to her chamber and posted her sisters on the castle ramparts. She knelt to pray, but instead called out to her sisters. Sisters, sisters, do you see our brothers coming? We see nothing, nothing on the open plains. Every few minutes she cried up to the ramparts. Sisters, sisters, do you see our brothers coming? We see a whirlwind, perhaps a dust devil in the distance. Meanwhile, Bluebeard roared for his wife to come to the cellar so he could behead her. Again she called out, sisters, sisters, I mean it this time, do you see our brothers coming? Bluebeard shouted for his wife again and began to clomp up the stone steps. Her sisters then cried out, yes, yes, we see them coming. Our brothers are here, and they've just entered the castle. Well, Bluebeard strode down the hall towards his wife's chamber. I am coming to get you, he bellowed. His footfalls were dense. The rocks in the hallway came loose. The sand from the mortar poured onto the floor. As Bluebeard lumbered into her chamber with his hands outstretched to seize her, her brothers on horseback galloped down the castle hallway and charged into her room as well. There they routed Bluebeard out onto the parapet. There and then, with swords, they advanced upon him, striking and slashing, cutting and whipping, beating Bluebeard down to the ground, killing him at last, and leaving him for the buzzards who ate his blood and gristle. And that is the story of Bluebeard. Bluebeard, that natural predator within all of us who just, we just can't not look at those dark places sometimes, can we? So, anyway, the story of Bluebeard, it's really interesting. I thought I would pick that to read tonight because Sagittarius really is about expanding our vision, dealing with our curiosity. And, you know, as they say, sometimes curiosity killed the cat. It's not always a good thing to be curious. We have to be able to discriminate when is a good time to be curious and to look where we're not supposed to look and when it's better not to even go there. One of the beautiful things that Clarissa Estes says in this about this story in her book, Women Who Run with the Wolves, is that we have this natural predator within us. I remember my son, when he was little, he used to dream about sharks a lot, but he developed the ability to have lucid dreams. And so when he would be in a dream where the sharks were after him, he would be able to remember that he was dreaming and he would say, oh, I need a boat. And a boat would appear and he would escape the sharks. Well, the sharks represent that same sort of predatory part in us, that part that pulls us down, that keeps telling us we're no good, that wants to destroy us, if you will. And Bluebeard is really about that part. And that's the other side. That's the darkness that I think that we find in this month of December when, as Lantern and I were saying, it's so beautiful out. It's just beginning to become winter. The air is getting cold and crispy. And then, of course, we have all the holidays that we celebrate for the coming of the light at winter solstice. But before then, we have to face the darkness. And I think that this story of Bluebeard is very much about how we can't be naive about the darkness. There is great darkness out there right now in our world. It's in the time of the year that we're living in. There's a wonderful book by Susan Cooper called The Dark is Rising. It's part of a book series that she wrote for children. And the whole idea that the dark or evil isn't really there is just as foolish as the idea that the darkness and the devil are behind everything. There needs to be some kind of a balance. And I think a lot of it has to do with our being sure about what we believe and also really secure in what we value.
Well, that's where the old yin-yang comes into play, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. So, hi, Lantern.
Beautiful story.
Yeah, it's a hard story and a good story, but definitely. So I wanted to ask you, what did you think of that wonderful story you told? You always find such amazing stories.
Well, I do a lot of research in early European legends, and I thought, for the wonderful stories of the magical time between Halloween and the solstice holidays, I wanted to find something that was an unusual tale, that was heroic, that our hero was set new tasks, and this idea of the villain being invincible because his wealth was not kept in the usual place, that struck me as an interesting twist. And I'm reading a book of old ancient Russian legends and fables, and I've come across that particular twist in a couple stories. So
yeah.
that was a neat thing, and I think I take that as a lesson. I think that we're vulnerable when we keep when we hold too lightly to those things that are important, and if we keep, if we don't hold our faith in things, if we don't hold our faith in stuff, if we keep our what we call our wealth in our family, in our loved ones, in values, they're not so easy to steal, they're not so easy to be damaged. And I took that as a really interesting metaphor on where do you keep your value? Is your value in the car that you drive? Is the value in the name that you get when you work? Or is what you value something far more elusive and something far harder to take?
Yes. That's so important, because that's really one of the big questions, don't you think, that's facing our society today. What do we value?
Well, I think the upheavals that we see, whether it be the Occupy movement or this horrendous abuse of economics that's going on, or this absolutely curious circus that's the Republican candidates, it seems to be so much about values. What's important? What's valuable? We didn't see this war come to a conclusion in Iraq. We were thrown out, and it seems what the Iraqis valued was, they want to be in charge of their own ground, as a matter of fact. And I think that more Americans would understand what's really going on if they thought about it and put that shoe on their own foot and said, how would you like some superpower to take care of you like that, by blowing you up and by driving through your streets so fast that people just get run over? And I think there's an important lesson there. And I know when I hear people say, maybe economics isn't what it's all about, maybe a McMansion isn't what I really need, if this is the way they have to take the lesson, then I hope they get the lesson.
Yeah, we're having so many lessons right now, and it really is all about all of us waking up. We have, at some point, we'll have to do some Garden of Eden type stories, I think, because we're really at a place where we need to go back to our creation stories, if you will, and decide, what do we want to create? I know I was writing a letter to my representative today. It's about the fact that they want to pass a bill in Congress where we're not allowed to talk to the Iranians. It would be against the law for a diplomat to, unless they got permission or something. And it's just, how sophomoric is that? You cannot create peace without communication.
I
wonder sometimes if people who are running the world, they've lost sight of really the important things in life.
And not to mention some of these tremendously curious rules about nutrition, where you can't eat whole milk, or you can't take vitamins, or you can't grow your own food. I mean, there are some really bizarre values being out there. And I think you're right. I think we're creating a new society. When Occupy exists without a leader and there's a consensus, that's a new kind of social organism, and I think that's really wonderful.
Yeah. We're in the brink. We're at the death of an old world, but also the the birth of a new world, hopefully. And as a mother with four children, childbirth is about laboring, and it's hard work, and it can be painful, but the end result is quite beautiful.
Well, I want to thank you, Kat. You did a wonderful job telling our story tonight.
Yes, and so did you. And so please join us again at the Bard's Grove next Friday. Merry meet and merry part.
And merry
meet again.
Take care. Good night, Kat. Travel safe.
Night.